This week I'm joined by King County Superior Court Judge John Ehrlich. Judge Ehrlich is a very respected member of the bench, and he was gracious enough to give us some of his time. He's currently doing a rotation on the King County Juvenile Court. We talk about the laws around juvenile court, some of the tougher cases that he's encountered, and resources available for children and families that are having trouble.
Thanks for tuning in. Host Noah Weil is a licensed attorney admitted to practice in Washington State and the Federal Court of the Western District of Washington. Some guests on this program may be licensed attorneys as well. However, the discussion on this podcast is intended to be informative only and is not a substitute for legal advice for your particular situation. The information may be right or may be wrong. Changing laws and the laws of individual states mean the information presented here may not be accurate. But regardless, and this part is important, neither Noah nor any guest here is your lawyer. If you need a lawyer for your individual situation, you should consult and retain your own attorney.
Now, this is Noah Weil with the Better Noah Lawyer podcast, and today I'm joined by the Honorable Judge John Ehrlich of the King County Juvenile Court. Judge Ehrlich, thanks for being here today.
My pleasure.
So, Judge Ehrlich, if you could start off with just telling us how long you've been a judge, what other work you've done, things of that nature.
You bet. So, I have been on the bench for just about 15 years. It'll be 15 years next month, and I was elected in September of 2000, and I took the bench in January of 2001, which was right before the Nisqually earthquake, which we had in the King County Courthouse in end of February. Prior to that, for almost 20 years, I was in private practice. For better than half my practice, I did professional liability defense work, which meant representing primarily lawyers, but also other professionals as well, real estate brokers, insurance brokers, and agents. I had a few dental malpractice cases and the like, but primarily a legal malpractice was the type of case that I represented attorneys on.
Now, you're a King County Superior Court judge.
Correct.
Currently assigned or stationed at the juvenile court system.
That's right.
So we don't have special juvenile court judges in this county or the state. It's just Superior Court judges that have this rotation.
That's right. So the Superior Court judges in King County, actually all throughout the state of Washington, are what are called judges of general jurisdiction. General jurisdiction means that we are elected to handle all types of cases, and that includes family law, civil law, criminal law, mental illness court, and juvenile court. In other states, some judges, some family law judges, as well as juvenile judges, are directly elected by the voters to that position. I know in, I believe, Chicago, they elect their probate judges specifically for that position. So in King County Superior Court, courts of general jurisdiction, we handle all types of cases.
Is that challenging for Superior Court judges to have such a wide variety of cases on their plate?
I think there's a certain challenge. This is a debate we've had internally, whether judges should be assigned to one court and just handle civil cases for their career or juvenile cases for their career. I think it's good for, since we are judges of general jurisdiction, to be cross-trained in all areas. Now, that said, I haven't had a jury trial now in 2 years because in juvenile court, it's only bench trials. So, of course, I'm going to go back downtown next month and sort of relearn how to pick a jury and oversee a jury case. But it's a little bit like riding a bicycle. I expect it'll come back to me pretty quickly.
Well, because you're in the juvenile court rotation right now, that's what I'd like to talk to you about today.
Certainly. Okay.
So give us kind of the introduction to juvenile court.
There is the offender part. There's the dependency part. But there's also a status part, which is called BECA, and that doesn't fall within either category. So the BECA court or the BECA calendar is a law that was based on a young girl who ran away She was taken advantage of by individuals, and eventually she lost her life. So the state legislature set up a special statute that allows juvenile court to oversee youth who are called at-risk youth, ARY, or CHINS, which is children, child in need of services. And those are both petitions that can be brought before the court so that a child who doesn't rise to the level of dependency, but because of challenges at home, doesn't have the support and may not be attending school or might have other challenges. So that falls within BECA. The truancy calendar also falls within BECA, and those are referrals from schools where students are not attending school. So those are really the three components that we see in juvenile court. We also have a special drug court, which is also an offender court, but where a youth or juvenile is diverted into drug courts, they can get treatment rather than they're spending time in detention or going to JRA.
So let's start with BECA then.
Sure.
Besides the schools bringing truancy petitions, how else would a child fall into the BECA categories and appear before you?
Those are petitions that are brought by either a family member or by a child, him or herself. So they can petition the court. For example, if a child is not being provided with basic services, their parents aren't feeding them, their parents aren't clothing them, their parents aren't providing proper housing, they can file a CHINS petition with the court. By the same token, if a youth isn't returning home, is running away, is on the streets, using drugs, not necessarily part of the offender system, but needs some support or services or programs to assist the family in reintegrating that youth back in the family, a parent or guardian could bring an at-risk youth petition.
I like the idea of children kind of holding their parents accountable for their basic needs, but how do kids learn about this? How do they actually get the resources to file this petition if they think they're eligible for it?
Usually it's through the school system, or they may end up in, you've probably seen the Safe Streets program. These are businesses and other places where youth need a place to go, and they end up there. And usually it's through law enforcement, but they're not part of the offender system. Law enforcement advise them of their rights and ability to file these petitions with the court.
And how does the courts assist in having the parents provide them services? Do they hail them to court, or is there some kind of action
we do.
Plan?
We bring them into court. Usually there's what's called an FCS referral, which is under DSHS, and they provide its family court services. They do an investigation and an evaluation and make recommendations to the court for the programs that should be made available either to the youth or the family members, the parents, or all of the above.
And then on the flip side, how does it work when the parents come to court and petition for help with their children that are abusing the system or, you know, running away or something like that?
Usually it's the same way. Parents will call the police and say, my child has run away. I can't control my child. My child's using drugs. My child's out of control at home. And they're not, it hasn't risen to the level, for example, where there is a physical assault at home where there may be referral to the offender side, but it might just be verbal. It might be just this confrontation where a parent really needs help. And they usually just end up calling the police, and the police will refer the parent to our BECA calendar and have them file an at-risk youth petition.
And then the parents and the children come and plans are created and checked in with every once in a while?
That's correct. That's right. They're usually under the court's jurisdiction for no more than 6 months. And there's a program and a schedule to bring them back into court, see how things are doing. And we have lots of services available to the families. There's family integrative therapy, which is FIT. FFT is family functional therapy. Sorry about all the acronyms. MST is multi-system systemic therapy. And the caseworker from DSHS assigned to the case is aware of all these programs and make a recommendation to the court as to which program or programs the youth and the family should be referred to.
Does it work?
You know, mixed results, yes. I mean, we hear of great success stories where there's just, they need an intermediary, they need a mediator to work with the youth and the family to dissipate some of the tension there, and we hear things are going great at home. On the other hand, we hear of parents or kids that don't want to participate, and no program's going to work if you don't get participation. Sometimes there is participation, but it just is not a good fit, and things don't work out, and the youth continues to run away. Sometimes there's something underlying where the program, it can't address it. For example, substance abuse or some mental health issues, and these types of programs really aren't set up for that. In terms of, they can refer the youth to other types of program, like mental health treatment or substance abuse treatment, but if a youth doesn't want to go into inpatient treatment, for example, and needs inpatient treatment, we don't have the authority to send the youth there under these circumstances.
Okay, so let's talk about the next phase of court involvement, which is the offenders.
Right.
Just to start off with, what is the minimum and maximum age a defendant could be in this court, and what are the kinds of crimes you see most commonly?
So minimum, I believe, is 8 years old, although I've never seen anyone that young. Maximum is up to age 18. So once you turn 18, you can no longer be prosecuted in juvenile court. You go to adult court. That said, we have youth who are over 18 who are within our system because they were adjudicated, which is a fancy word for convicted. They were adjudicated within our system under the age of 18, and we still have jurisdiction up to the age of 21. It's a little bit confusing because we can't prosecute over age 18, but they can remain within our system up to 21. So, for example, if I have a youth who is before me and they plead guilty to a crime and I put them on supervision, which is the terminology we use in juvenile court for probation, for a year, they will be up to age 18 and a half and still be within my jurisdiction.
But if they're in the middle of trial and on day three, they had their 18th birthday?
No, if we've started a trial, then we've retained jurisdiction. We can extend jurisdiction for purposes of adjudication. But if they commit a crime after age 18, they will go to the adult system.
Okay, so it's when the crime is committed?
Generally, well, it depends. It's when the case is filed.
Okay.
It's when the case is filed. You can't file a case against a youth over age 18.
And what are some of the most common offenses you see in juvenile court?
Can't say that. There is no, I mean, we really have everything. Obviously, we have a lot more lower level crimes, such as theft in the third degree. So that's theft of property under $250. One of the crimes we see a lot is theft of iPhones,
sure,
as well as other personal devices. Now, the problem with that is that if there is force used, and a lot of youth don't understand this, if there's force used in taking property from another person, or if there is a threat of force, then that theft can become a robbery, which is a much more serious charge. And often we have what we call thefts gone bad, which turn into robbery. I'll give you a crime which we didn't really have several years ago, which we see a lot of, and that is theft of alcohol. Mm-hmm. And as you know, alcohol was only privatized a couple, 3 years ago. And before that, a youth couldn't get into a liquor store and steal a bottle of alcohol. But now they can go to the local QFC or Safeway or Walgreens or whoever's selling that alcohol, run in there, grab alcohol off the shelf, and run out. Now, if they do that, that's a theft three. But if the security guard runs after them and they push or shove the security guard, that can be prosecuted as a robbery, which is a much more serious offense.
Are there some crimes that are not heard in juvenile court, no matter the age of the person?
No. There are no crimes that are not heard in juvenile court. There are some crimes which are what is called automatic decline, and that would be rape first degree or murder over age 16 that automatically goes down to adult court.
But if a 14-year-old was accused of murder, that could be heard in juvenile court?
That's correct.
That must be challenging.
It's hard. I've had those cases. They're tragic. They're tragic on both sides. They're tragic, obviously, for the victim and the victim's family, but it's also tragic for the juvenile who may end up, is going to have murder on his or her record and could easily end up at the JRA until age 21. Now, the court does have the ability, in extraordinary circumstances, to decline even a youth under 16 to adult court. So I did have a rape of a child case where the victim was quite young. The perpetrator, juvenile, was, I believe, age 14, probably age 15 by the time he came to my court. And I felt it was more appropriate for the case to go to adult court because of the nature of the crime and the manner in which it was committed.
I assume that the defense would rather keep it in juvenile court?
Absolutely.
And so what are the kind of factors you look at to make that determination when you have two sides disagreeing on where it should go?
Those factors are statutory as well as by case law, and they are multi-factor. It includes the sophistication of the crime, the impact on the victim, the nature of the offense, prior criminal history, premeditation. There's a whole number of factors that can be considered by a juvenile court judge in determining whether to decline to adult court or not.
I think some people, maybe non-lawyers, have the belief that juvenile court's a softer place, that there's not really punishments, slaps on the wrist, that kind of thing. You said that the maximum sentence was until they turned 21.
That's correct.
But can you tell us more about what kinds of sentences a juvenile court can craft?
Sure. Well, first of all, let me be clear that I think it's a gross misperception. And the misperception is based upon the fact that the model at juvenile court is completely different than the adult court system. So the model in the adult court system is punishment. You do the crime, you pay the time. And I tell my youth that all the time because they could end up in the adult system at some point in their lives. And I want to understand that it's a very different model here. And if they recommit as an adult, they're looking at a very different punishment. The model in juvenile court is really rehabilitation. Now, for years, in adult court, there was a shift to that model, which was rehabilitation. Let's take these adult offenders, put them into prisons or institutions, try to rehabilitate them so that they can go back and get back into the community. There's been a shift away from that. We don't have the resources anymore as much. I'm not saying that prisons do not focus on rehabilitation. They do to a certain degree.
I don't mind saying that.
Yeah. I mean, certainly most prisons, and I've visited several in the state, provide educational programs, provide work programs, skills training, all of those sort of things. But those are done in the prisons. We try to keep the youth out of JRA, which is the Juvenile Rehabilitation Authority institution, such as Green Hill, Echo Glen, or the Nacelle Work Camp. We want to keep them out of there, and therefore we do whatever we can to provide them with treatment programs in the community. The purpose of all of that is to keep the youth out of the system. In other words, to lower recidivism rates, to give them the skills so they can learn that if you hang out with the wrong people, you hang out with the wrong group, you're going to be incentivized to join your buddies and commit robbery or theft or some other type, but theft of a motor vehicle. So the focus is really quite different, and we have so many more programs available in the community to youth and their families than are available in adult system. I would not say that it's a slap on the wrist. We put a lot of youth on the electronic home monitoring, which is essentially house arrest. That means they can only be one of two places. They have to be home or they have to be at school. And nobody likes their liberty restrained in that fashion. We have youth who have to go to therapy programs. We have youth who are forced to attend school. So I would in no way say that this is a slap on the wrist when your liberties are restrained and you're required to go to programs and counseling and services mandated by the court. And if you don't comply, you end up in detention.
I'm thinking back to my youth, and I would, well, one, I'm happy I didn't get caught, but two, I would be very unhappy if I had a bracelet on my ankle when I was a teenager.
No youth is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a thing. But I'm curious then, because there's this emphasis on rehabilitation and keeping them out of the system, if the process is just less adversarial than adult court, are the lawyers more collaborative with the court in crafting resolutions?
Unquestionably. Unquestionably. The adult model is the prosecution wants to prove that someone committed a crime and punish them for it. That's the model. The model in juvenile court is what can the prosecution and the defense come up with which is in the best interest of the child for his future and keeping him out of the juvenile justice system. A completely different model. I would say that probably 90% plus of my cases are presented to this court as a guilty plea with a joint or agreed recommendation to the court. Sometimes there's a little bit of difference in terms of the length of supervision that a juvenile probation counselor might be recommending versus what the defense attorney wants. But for the most part, it's all trying to reach the same goal, and that is what's best to keep the kid out of the system.
I'm aware that the adult recidivism rate is about 31% in the state. Do you know what the numbers are for juveniles?
I wish I did. We are working on some current numbers right now in terms of recidivism rates, but in terms of King County youth, we don't have anything current, and we have people that are researching that right now. The old numbers are some Washington State Institute for Public Policy numbers, I think, that are stale at this point and probably not very accurate. So we don't know what the current recidivism is.
Do you think, in your own experience, and I realize there's no statistical basis behind it, but in your personal experience, do you feel this model is working? Do you think that you're having an impact on these kids that they're not going to be in front of you again, or even as an adult?
Well, the answer has to be yes for some and no for others. I hear success stories, not as many as I would like, but I do hear success stories. I have parents coming in and saying, Judge, I don't know what happened, but you know, my son turned around and he's going to school, his grades are good, he hasn't gotten into trouble. And, you know, we don't know what the magic formula is, but we offer all the youth services and programs. Some of them are a good fit, some of them work, and the kids don't come back. And other youth are offered similar programs, similar services, and they keep coming back. And for me, one of the biggest factors, and I tell the juveniles this all the time, one of the biggest factors is who they hang out with. Because as we all know, youth are very, very impressionable. And it's hard for a young person to say no to his friends. And his friends say, let's go steal a car, let's go break into that house. Kid wants to be part of an accepted group, and it's hard to say no. And so they do. So many of our crimes are committed in groups of kids, which is something that we don't see nearly as often in the adult system.
A couple episodes ago, I was talking to a Seattle police officer, and we agreed on some things and disagreed on others on the adult justice system. We both agreed that people who go into jail usually don't leave better for it. Again, we're talking about adults here. And you mentioned the lack of services, lack of resources in the jails. It sounds like the juveniles have better opportunities than the adults do.
Without question.
Is there anything that you think should be added that they're just not the resources for, or programs you'd like to see enhanced?
I know that our court, including one of my colleagues, Judge Barb Mack, is working on a mental health court, and that's something we don't have here. We do have drug court, and what the drug court does is really focus on the underlying substance abuse problems so that those youth who are addicted have an opportunity not to go through the offender system. It's a diversion. We would like to do the exact same thing with the mental illness or mental health court, and that would operate on the same principles. Now, what's interesting is so many of the youth that go through the drug court program are co-occurring. What I mean by co-occurring, I mean that they have both mental health issues as well as substance abuse issues. But if they have mental health issues but don't have substance abuse issues, they're not eligible for drug court. So we want to set up another court where if they have a mental health issue, as so many of our youth do, we can divert them to that court, get them the necessary treatment, and if they're successful, keep them out of the offender side of the equation. They have a similar court to this for adults in King County District Court for diversion purposes for adults who have mental health problems. We would like to see the same model for our courts.
I have a friend I went to law school with. He was or is prosecuting on the juvenile side. I'm not going to say his name. I don't know if he's still doing it. He probably wouldn't want me to quote him, but he pulled me aside one time and said, Noah, I know we have this idea that kids are, you know, a little more innocent, a little more naive, but I've seen some evil things from these children, and I'm much more cynical about the potential for bad things from kids. Then we have the U.S. Supreme Court that says children are different.
That's correct.
We can't execute them. We can't give them a life imprisonment. They are physiologically, mentally, socially different than adults, which seems a little bit at odds with what my friend said. So I'm kind of curious, what do you think? I know what the Supreme Court says, and of course you'll follow their directives, but in your personal experience, what do you think about kids compared to adults in general, just their potential, their mental processes, that kind of thing?
Well, I don't think those two observations are inconsistent, and I'll tell you why. There's no question but that youth don't have complete brain development. I mean, there's been so many studies that have been done that makes them more susceptible to impulsive conduct and activity, which is and impressionability. So that's why I gave you the example of how hard it is for a juvenile to turn down his buddies who want to commit a crime. And that's because of impulsivity. That's because of the need to be accepted. That's because of lack of self-esteem. All the things that I think we all went through when we were youth. I think youth have much greater difficulty, one, understanding what a bad decision is, and two, understanding what the consequences are going to be. And also, youth are more susceptible to the impact of substance abuse, such as alcohol or marijuana, which, as we know, is now legal in the state of Washington. As an adult, I think most adults understand what the impact is going to be on them or what the effect is going to be. With youth, it's a lot harder, and part of that is their brain is still developing. And what happens is that the impact on the juvenile brain from use of alcohol and particularly use of marijuana is so much greater than it is as an adult. It's also a depressant, there's been studies that show that on female youth, the impact of marijuana is even greater in terms of resulting in a depressive affect as a consequence of use of marijuana. So, no question that the U.S. Supreme Court got it right. Developing brains, impulsive activity, lack of foresight in understanding consequences of one's actions. That said, I think that there are individuals out there, both as adults and as juveniles who are sociopathic or psychopathic. And that has really nothing to do with the fact that they're juveniles, but the fact that they are somehow wired that way. And these kids and adults, as we know, commit horrific crimes. And I'm talking about the Gary Ridgways of the world or the Jeffrey Dahmers of this world. They are outliers, and I don't think we can say that just because we have those types of individuals, either as youth or adults, that that's inconsistent with the concept of juvenile's brain is still developing and susceptible to impulsivity. Those are different juveniles. Those are different adults.
Is it frustrating for you as a judge when you see somebody before you, an adult or a juvenile, and you think, I know I'm going to see this person again. There's no punishment that I can craft or no services that I can offer that will prevent them from coming before me again. You've got to be doing this long enough that you can get a sense of the revolving door people.
Well, I will say that having served a number of years downtown and overseeing many, many criminal cases and presiding over many sentencing hearings, I don't think much about it as when I'm on sentencing an adult offender. And the reason is I think that they are adults. They can make adult decisions. And many of them are such high recidivists that I never believe anything I say is likely to make a difference in their lives in terms of their decision making. The only time that I feel compelled to talk to an adult about the choices is when they're a very young adult, when they're 18 or 19 or 20, and they're before me on their first felony, and I have to explain to them that this is the point in their life that they have to make decisions on whether they're just going to be in the revolving door of institutions or they want to change their lives. With youth, I think it's so much more unpredictable. And I generally don't give up on any of my youth, with a few exceptions. And the one I told you about was the rape case that I just sent to adult court because I just felt as though this was an individual who I had severe doubts about whether or not this person had much hope for rehabilitation. But the whole, I can't say that the frustration is not when the youth is before me and I think they're going to reoffend in the future. My frustration is when they're before me and I had high hopes the last time they weren't going to reoffend. And sure. I get frustrated, but I never give up hope on them.
Is there any common factors? I know you can't have any universal things for everybody that appears before you, but is there any common factors you see in the juvenile offenders, be it economic upbringing or family life or gender, maybe anything that you see that makes someone more or less likely to appear before you?
You know, I think that there is probably a socioeconomic factor involved. To a certain degree, it depends on the crime. But I do think that socioeconomically, I think kids that don't have as many things, who want to have things, are more likely to commit a theft or a robbery. And other crimes, sex crimes in particular, I will tell you it is entirely over the spectrum, socioeconomically. Socioeconomics does not dictate in any sense, one way or another, whether someone's going to commit a sex-related crime. Such as a rape or child molestation. The families are really all over the board. I mean, some of them, they come in and some kids don't have families. They get tossed around from one foster home to another, or they're and the care of DSHS, we have a lot of overlap between dependent kids and offender kids. And I think that's self-explanatory. These kids don't have the support, they don't have the structure, and a lot of them don't have the self-esteem to stay out of the offender system. On the other hand, I've had kids come in here, they have two parents, come from a nice household, parents are supportive, parents care, and yet the kid's out of control. He wants to hang with his friends, his buddies, and commit crimes. So I don't think there's any one factor, although certainly I think it's more challenging for youth to stay out of trouble when they don't have the support of at least one parent at home, or they're not in a stable foster home.
Well, the reason I ask is not, you know, to target anybody, but to think about if you have any ideas on what, from a societal point of view, we can address what needs fixing to have less of most at-risk kids, make them less at risk.
You know, this is the big issue right now. And as you know, we're trying to build a new Children's and Family Justice Center. There's a lot of money going into a building. A lot of activists are opposed to the building, saying the money should go into services. And I think that there's some validity to their arguments, in the sense that I think that providing stable housing, providing better shelter and other services and programs can help youth. I don't think building this building and providing those services are in any way mutually exclusive. And we are trying now, you know, our numbers are way, way down. On any given night, we only have 60 to 70 youth in detention in this building. And when you think about that's out of a population of somewhere between, I think, 1.7 million plus in King County, that's a pretty extraordinary number. Now, can we get those numbers down? We would love to. We work on that all the time. But the reality is that if you have a youth who assaults a parent at home, threatens them with a kitchen knife, and they come in on an assault for domestic violence charge, you can't send that youth back into that household. And so what we do is we set up services so we can release them from detention and put them back in the household with the services provided to the family as well as to the youth to make sure that that tension dissipates. So what do we do with that youth? Well, we're looking for alternatives. Another one of my colleagues, Judge Gina Cahan, is working with the police where we could have an alternative living arrangement for those youth who are brought in for assault for domestic violence charges. But the fact of the matter is there are going to be youth who commit very violent crimes that we as judicial officers have the duty and the obligation to protect the community. And no one wants to see any youth in detention, but sometimes there are simply no alternatives. Sometimes the youth are a sufficient threat to the community that they have to be in detention until we determine or resolve their cases. So are there programs or services? I think that we know in the adult system, the crime rises and falls with the economy. And I think what that speaks to is the fact that if we can improve the economy in general, if we can provide better housing, more support, mental health services, substance abuse services, that we can work harder in getting those numbers down. But I think that will we ever eradicate violent crime? I would love to see that happen. Will it happen? I don't know of any place where it has. I need to get ready for my next meeting.
Of course. Judge Ehrlich, thank you so much for taking the time today.
Noah, it's been absolutely my pleasure. Thank you for your very insightful questions. And I do hope that we can better our system in the future.
I look forward to that as well. Thank you, Judge.
Thank you.